This is the BBC.
Order, order.
Hello, I'm Susan Hume, and this is the Today in Parliament podcast for Thursday, the 20th of July. Coming up, after angry scenes at a meeting of Kensington and Chelsea Council, the Community Secretary admits survivors feel let down.
There's not a lot of trust there, not a lot of confidence.
Also tonight, dismay that the government's health department should be involved in the inquiry into blood contamination.
Contaminated blood campaigners boycotted a meeting organised by the Department of Health at 10 a.m. today in protest.
And the Culture Secretary is warned on the Sky takeover bid not to give in to the tricks of the Murdochs.
Which is to try and bully people into making wrong decisions and rush decisions. Yeah.
But first, the Community Secretary Sajid Javid has said permanent new homes will be ready for survivors of the Grenfell Tower fire within days. Giving an update to MPs before Parliament breaks for the summer, he made a new appeal for anyone to come forward with fresh information about how many people may have been in the block on the night of the fire. His comments come after survivors and their families heckled the new leader of Kensington and Chelsea at an emotional meeting of the council.
We saw last night the very raw anger that some in the community still feel towards the council. It's entirely understandable. As the Prime Minister herself has said, the initial response from the local authority was simply not good enough. There's not a lot of trust there, not a lot of confidence.
The minister said that once the council took control again of the operation, it would be overseen by the Grenfell Tower Task Force. He said everyone who'd lost their home had been made at least one offer of good quality accommodation in the local area.
As of 10 a.m. this morning, 35 of these have been accepted and 10 families have moved in. Those numbers are slightly down on the figures that were published recently, as some people have changed their minds, as they are perfectly entitled to do so. Where residents have turned down an offer, we are finding suitable alternatives for them.
He invited Labour to come and inspect the temporary homes, and he said a team was in place to start matching families to new permanent homes that would be ready within days. But Labour spokesman John Healey was still sceptical.
I'm still getting reports of residents told they will be made intentionally homeless if they refuse an offer, despite the government's word that this will not happen. Residents offered accommodation with damp, leaks and lack of full furnishing.
And he was worried about fire safety checks on other towers. Sajid Javid said that 208 high-rise blocks around England had cladding of the same sort as Grenfell. But researchers were still waiting for samples from 7 of them, something he described as unacceptable. John Healey suspected the problem was not just the cladding.
This government's testing programme is simply too slow, too narrow, too confused, simply not fit for purpose. So can I say to the Secretary of State, ministers must now act, widen the testing programme to reassure all high-rise residents that their homes are safe.
Sajid Javid told him it was sensible to prioritise the cladding issue. For the SNP, Joanna Cherry questioned how the disaster could have happened in such a wealthy borough.
Was this just the failing of one out-of-touch Tory council? Or is it an endemic problem? And what steps are the government, the UK government, taking to make sure that such an inept and incompetent response to such a terrible disaster couldn't happen again?
The Labour MP Clive Betts chairs the Local Government Committee, and he was concerned about how local authorities would pay for any safety work needed out of their housing budgets.
Rents are capped, borrowing is capped, so for many authorities, the only way they'll be able to pay for extra work on tower blocks is to stop doing important work on other properties. Will the Secretary of State accept, under those circumstances, where work on tower blocks means not doing important work elsewhere, that is a circumstance in which central government will pay and help local authorities do the work necessary?
Sajid Javid said it was the responsibility of councils to do the work to make their properties safe.
If they need help with that, if they cannot afford it, they should approach us. But so far, I'm not aware of a single local authority that has done so.
The Lib Dem Tom Brake wanted new safety checks.
It would appear as though in the Grenfell Tower incident was caused by a fire in a fridge freezer. Will the Secretary of State commit to introducing mandatory electrical safety checks in rented properties?
Sajid Javid didn't respond to that directly, but said product testing was underway as a result of the Grenfell tragedy. Now, the government's been strongly criticised for allowing the Department of Health to be involved in an inquiry into the contaminated blood scandal. Labour's Diana Johnson said it was like asking South Yorkshire Police to lead an inquiry into the Hillsborough disaster. Rachel Byrne reports.
Thousands of haemophiliacs and other patients were given blood products infected with hepatitis C and HIV in the 1970s and 80s. Around 2,400 people have died. Last week, Theresa May announced a UK-wide inquiry into the scandal. The Labour MP and one-time Minister Diana Johnson, who has long fought for such an inquiry, said she and many others were dismayed to see the Department of Health in charge of establishing it.
The Department of Health, an implicated party at the heart of so much that has gone wrong over the past 45 years, must have no role in how this inquiry is established. It is akin, in my view, to asking South Yorkshire Police to lead an inquiry into the Hillsborough disaster.
She said putting the Department of Health in charge undermined the government's excellent decision to call the inquiry.
In consequence, contaminated blood campaigners boycotted a meeting organised by the Department of Health at 10 a.m. today in protest. Another department must surely now take over responsibility for consulting on the remit of this inquiry.
The Health Minister, Jackie Doyle-Price, was brought to the Commons to respond to Diana Johnson's concerns.
There has been no firm view taken as to which department will run the inquiry, but ultimately, as the Minister with responsibility to this area, I think the House would consider it amiss if I were not having meetings and discussions with those affected about the remit of this inquiry.
As for that morning's meeting...
The Secretary of State called this meeting because we want to hear directly from the victims about what they want from this inquiry. We are very much in listening mode.
A Conservative, Julian Lewis, said perception was very important.
And therefore, will she take away from this occasion this morning the weight placed by honourable members on both sides of the House that perhaps it would be perceived to be more objective if some other department took the lead?
The Shadow Health Minister, Sharon Hodgson, said a week ago the Commons had been united over the inquiry. Now...
Events have shown ministers to renege on last week's promises and have run roughshod over the affected community. You may shake your head, but that is how the community feel. We've spoken to them.
The minister said the government had not ignored concerns, stressing that no decision had been made about which department would oversee the inquiry. She explained why the Department of Health meeting had been arranged at short notice.
It is because we want to actually hear directly from people affected as soon as possible that such a meeting was arranged before the House rises.
But she told MPs that meeting had been just the start. Chris Stevens, an SNP MP, said things would have to be different next time.
Can I ask the Minister to reflect that it's not reasonable to ask campaign groups from Scotland to attend a meeting at 2 days' notice?
Jackie Doyle-Price said arrangements had been made.
Well, as I say, that was the first of what we hope will be many conversations. And I think the campaign groups in Scotland arrangements were made for them to dial in to the meeting so they could participate.
The minister said the government wanted to get on with the inquiry, but it was also committed to having good, effective dialogue to ensure confidence in the process.
Rachel Byrne reporting. Still to come, a minister has great news for Jane Austen fans. But first... Female broadcasters at the BBC who are paid less than their male colleagues enjoyed some support in the House of Lords today. Peers were strongly critical of the large pay levels given to some BBC presenters, such as the Radio 2 DJ Chris Evans, who it was revealed this week was paid around £2.25 million last year. Christina Cooper reports.
At the insistence of the government, the BBC has, for the first time, published a list of employees earning more than £150,000 a year. It turns out that the seven top earners are all men, and two-thirds of the highest-paid presenters are also men. For all that, the leader of Labour's peers, Lady Smith, started with the good news.
I think we should all be very proud of the BBC as a standard-bearer and a standard-setter for high-quality drama, entertainment, factual programmes and news.
She pointed out that other media organisations were not as open and transparent as the BBC. But as for the corporation's gender gap, she thought the revelations could mean losing some experienced and talented women.
Whilst Eddie Mayer's reference to the male anatomy on Newsnight last night might be a bit much for your lordship's house on the last day of term, It's hard to understand why the male Y chromosome justifies a higher salary. It is significant how many of our most senior, well-qualified, experienced women presenters and journalists are paid so much less than their male counterparts.
The Director General of the BBC, Lord Hall, has promised to sort the pay gap by 2020, a pledge welcomed by the Culture Minister, Lord Ashton.
I'm very pleased that the Director General of the BBC has admitted that this isn't good enough, and he's committed to narrowing the gap to make it equal by 2020. So I'm pleased that we did this. We've learnt some lessons, and I think it remains to be seen whether the gloomy prognostications of those who think it will harm the BBC come to pass.
Labour's Lady Royal was shocked by the omission of two presenters from Radio 4 Woman's Hour from the high earner list.
Neither Jenny Murray nor Jane Garvey, who I believe are excellent broadcasters, were not even mentioned, which means they earn less than £150,000 a year. And I think that closing the gender pay gap by 2020 is frankly too late.
By April next year, all UK companies with 250 or more workers will have to publish the difference between salaries for men and women, something the Liberal Democrat Lady Burt is looking forward to.
The publication of these figures has been a wake-up call for the BBC. And I note that other media organisations have gleefully criticised them. Well, my lords, we'll see what we'll see when they have to publish their pay gap figures next year.
But the Conservative, Lord Tebbit, thought opposition parties had a few gender issues of their own to tackle.
None of the opposition parties have ever seen fit to have a woman leader. This party, our party, has had two women prime ministers. Let them put their mouths, let them put their actions where their mouths are and elect a woman leader.
Eagerly picking up the baton, Lord Ashton proceeded to list the women in his life.
I serve a female prime minister, a female leader of the House. I'm answering a question from a female leader of the opposition. In my department, there's a female Secretary of State, a female Permanent Secretary, a female Government Whip. And when I recover from... when I go...
A bit of gender banter that got him a withering look from the Labour leader in the Lords, Lady Smith. But the minister pressed on, saying that he went home to a wife and four daughters. Lord Laming, a crossbench or independent peer, has spent his life working in social services. He thought some of the BBC salaries were extraordinarily large by any standards.
And when you contrast that with the public service, who are dealing with life and death issues day by day, doesn't it seem that the priorities have got really seriously out of order at this time? And could the noble Lord, the Minister, use his influence to indicate to the BBC that, frankly, this talk about we could lose these fantastic talents, why not?
The minister agreed, calling it a philosophical question around balancing cost versus value and priorities.
Christina Cooper reporting. And Lord Laming's point was raised in the Commons too by Conservative MP Nigel Evans.
I learned today that a gentleman called Derek Thompson, who apparently plays Charlie in Casualty, earns up to £400,000 a year. And yet, someone who is a real nurse earns round about £23,000 a year.
He suggested £1 billion of licence fee payers' money could be taken from the BBC and given to the NHS. And still on media matters, the Culture Secretary has told MPs she is still minded to refer Rupert Murdoch's 21st Century Fox takeover of Sky to the competition watchdog. Karen Bradley said a final decision could be reached in the coming weeks, but opposition MPs called for her to wait for them to return from the summer break before making an announcement. Here's Simon Jones.
Rupert Murdoch's firm, 21st Century Fox, already has 39% control of Sky, and it's putting forward an £11.7 billion deal to take full control. Mr. Murdoch's previous attempt was abandoned in the face of the phone hacking scandal in 2011. Last month, the Culture Secretary, Karen Bradley, said she was considering referring the takeover bid to the regulator, the Competition and Markets Authority. In the Commons, she said after the latest consultation, she was still unable to make a final decision.
What I can do, however, is confirm to the House that having carefully reviewed the party's representations and in the absence of further proposed undertakings, I am currently still minded to refer on the media plurality ground.
A reference to a warning from the media watchdog Ofcom that the deal risked the Murdoch family having increased influence over the UK's news agenda and the political process. Karen Bradley said she'd received a lot of representations about the takeover and it would take time to look at them all.
Bearing in mind the obligation to act promptly as part of this quasi-judicial process, I expect I will be in a position to come to a final decision on referral, including in respect to the broadcasting standard ground, in the coming weeks and potentially during summer recess.
The Shadow Culture Secretary, Tom Watson, welcomed what he called Ms Bradley's indecision.
She will be aware that whatever decision she makes, there is a strong possibility of judicial review by one side or the other. No doubt that has influenced her decision to tread carefully and slowly, and we respect her for that.
He said the announcement of a decision should wait until MPs return to Westminster in September.
It is not her job to operate to 21st Century Fox's corporate timetable. Yeah, yeah. They have to abide by the parliamentary timetable. Yeah. And she should demonstrate to them that she is, as an elected representative of the people, who is in charge, not them.
A demand echoed by the SNP's Hannah Bardell.
The fact that a decision will likely be made during summer recess, it speaks to a developing pattern, Mr Speaker, that we have seen during the election with major decisions being made, and it is not good governance. It means it's been kicked into the long grass, and members and this House will not get an opportunity to scrutinise a decision.
The former Labour leader, Ed Miliband, is a long-standing opponent of Rupert Murdoch's plans to take full control of Sky.
At the beginning of September, she can come back after having a good summer and scrutinising these issues and telling us her decision. I think it's the right thing to do, and she shouldn't, as my right honourable friend said, give in to the old tricks of the Murdochs, which is to try and bully people into making wrong decisions and rush decisions.
Karen Bradley said she was being as open as she could be and had said that she may make a decision over the summer.
But it may take longer. I am taking the time to look at all representations, including the representation from the Right Honourable Gentleman and the Right Honourable Gentleman and the other Right Honourable Gentleman who isn't here, to make sure that we do consider all those points, and I will look at the evidence and make a decision on the basis of the evidence.
The former business secretary and, as of today, Lib Dem leader Sir Vince Cable raised the information Sky holds on its subscribers. He wanted an assurance.
The 13 million data sets that will be handed over to Fox as a result of the takeover cannot be misused or misapplied for political purposes.
The culture secretary made no promises, saying Sir Vince would know the evidence she could use to come to a decision.
Simon Jones reporting. Now, the UK could sleepwalk into a food crisis if the impact of Brexit on agriculture isn't properly managed. That was one of the findings of a report produced this week by food policy experts. Its conclusions have been seized on by Labour, with MPs voicing concerns about food supplies and standards post-Brexit. Rob Powell reports.
Labour accused the government of complacency over the possible impact of Brexit on what the country eats and drinks. The Shadow Environment Secretary, Sue Hayman, said the number of seasonal farm workers coming from the EU was already dropping. She wondered if ministers had a plan.
Food production, processing and packaging rely heavily on migrant labour. The ONS says 41% of the workforce. So why is the government ignoring the industry's warnings? Is it going to compensate for the loss of produce as a direct result of this complacency?
The Food Minister, George Eustace, told her the government would be commissioning research on the country's labour force needs after Brexit. And he gave short shrift to warnings from the Science Policy Research Unit of a looming food crisis.
They haven't looked at the issues as closely as we have within DEFRA. We've been studying all of these issues at tremendous length. The truth about food security is it depends on increasing food production globally on a sustainable level. It depends on open markets around the world. And these are challenges whether we are in or out of the EU. There is nothing about leaving the EU that will affect our food security.
It wasn't so much security as standards that were worrying the Conservative, Vicky Ford.
What steps is my right honourable friend taking to ensure that British farm standards are not undermined by cheaper less welfare-friendly products from other parts of the world after we leave the EU.
Replying this time was the Environment Secretary, Michael Gove. He said the government's commitment was clear.
While we want to lead the world in free trade, we also want to remain a world leader in animal welfare. There will be no compromise on our standards.
The Lib Dem, Alistair Carmichael, said he was proud of the culinary offerings in his constituency.
The finest food to be found anywhere includes Shetland lamb and Orkney beef.
To some hungry-sounding groans of approval from his party colleagues, Mr Carmichael said he was concerned what the future held for the protection of these items.
These fine products, Mr Speaker, get a lot of protection from the Protected Geographical Status and Protected Designation of Origin schemes, which we currently enjoy as part of the European Union.
Michael Gove admitted to a penchant for smoked Orkney cheese. He said he would ensure that British food continued to enjoy its status around the world. The Conservative, Nigel Evans, was also keen to highlight his preferences.
It's no surprise I love British food and drink, particularly Lancashire cheese and British beer, both produced in my constituency in the Ribble Valley. Can he ensure that as we approach Brexit and we approach these trade deals, that we do a lot more to ensure that many more markets around the world can enjoy the food that I enjoy here in this country?
But other MPs were less confident about the future. Labour's Ben Bradshaw raised a recent outburst on Twitter by Michael Gove's former political adviser, Dominic Cummings, who was also the campaign director for Vote Leave. In his tweets, Dominic Cummings was less than complimentary about the Brexit Secretary, David Davis.
Is as thick as mince, lazy as a toad, and as vain as Narcissus an appropriate description to use of a fellow cabinet member? And if hard Brexiteers in our government are falling out in this way, Mr Speaker, how on earth can the Secretary of State expect our European Union partners to take our negotiations seriously?
Michael Gove replied thus.
The Right Honourable Gentleman, I'm sure, is aware that we're working well together in government. And I don't recognise the description that he just gave as fitting any member of this House.
The Environment Secretary, Michael Gove, being diplomatic.
Rob Powell reporting. And a little later, the Leader of the House, Andrea Leadsom, announced that the EU Withdrawal Bill, which repeals the European Communities Act 1972 and transfers EU law into UK law, will get its first Commons debate over 2 days when MPs return in September. Andrea Leadsom also fielded complaints from many Labour MPs that the Transport Secretary, Chris Grayling, had failed to come along to inform them in person that he'd decided to scrap plans to electrify major rail lines in South Wales, the Lake District and the Midlands. Bi-mode trains, which can run on diesel or overhead power lines, are to be used instead. The Swansea East MP, Carolyn Harris, felt she and her constituents had been misled.
I've repeatedly sought clarity on rail electrification to Swansea. A succession of Transport Secretaries and Secretary of State for Wales have responded that I need only look out of the train window to see that electrification was on its way. Today, sneaked out in a statement, my worst fears have been realised.
And Labour's Vernon Coker spoke.
About the fury that there is in South Wales and in Rochdale, and not least that in the East Midlands in Nottingham, about the government's reneging on promises that were made about rail electrification. There were clear promises made about this. It wasn't just, oh, it might happen.
Andrea Leadsom said there was no question of the news being sneaked out. As for the electrification, this decision would be better for passengers.
The point is that as technology changes, there are earlier ways to improve passenger services for Welsh train users, and it's therefore vital that we seize those opportunities to deliver improvements earlier in a more cost-effective way and with less disruption to passenger services.
But another Swansea Labour MP, Geraint Davis, pointed to the environmental issues around continuing to use diesel locomotives.
We've now a situation where larger, heavier diesel trains will run to Cardiff, then switch on their diesel engine at Cardiff, which isn't environmentally friendly. Will she admit to this House that the Public Accounts Committee has a solution to this problem, namely that this project is £2 billion over budget and a year delayed because the Department of Transport had to bought the trains before laying the track and didn't anticipate there were bridges in the way? It's the incompetence of the transport Transport Secretary, who's this led to a slap in the face of the people of Swansea and Wales.
Andrea Leadsom refused to accept that.
Well, I do not for the life of me see why the Honourable Gentleman is refusing to acknowledge that earlier improvements for passengers with less disruption can possibly be a slap in the face.
And she argued that the bi-mode trains technology would allow the Department for Transport to upgrade the line more quickly and with less disruption to passengers. It's now 13 months since the EU referendum, but allegations about the fairness of the campaign continue to surface. The Labour MP Ben Bradshaw had a question for his colleague, who speaks on behalf of the Electoral Commission, about claims of overseas interference.
Could my honourable friend confirm, or if not ask, the Electoral Commission whether it has received allegations of illegal financial funding from Russia to elements of the Leave campaign?
Replying for the Electoral Commission was Labour's Bridget Phillipson.
The Commission is aware of some media reports that allege there could have been Russian involvement in the EU referendum. These cover a wide range of alleged activity which are beyond the remit of the Commission. Any allegation with evidence that a registered campaigner accepted impermissible donations from Russia would be investigated in line with the Commission's enforcement policy. But I'm sure that officials from the Commission would be more than happy to meet with my humble friend to discuss this matter further.
Bridget Phillipson there. A new MP, Matt Rodder, managed to make his first or maiden speech before the Commons finished up for the summer. He's the Labour MP for Reading East. His neighbour, the MP for Reading West, is the Housing Minister, Alok Sharma, and he warned him that housing would be one of his top priorities.
Reading, rather like London, regrettably suffers from some considerable income inequality, which leads to even greater issues with housing affordability. As a result, there's a desperate need for more affordable housing, both council houses and affordable homes to buy, and indeed homes to rent. And our renters locally particularly deserve a fair deal.
Labour's Matt Rodder there. Finally, when the Commons leader Andrea Leadsom was answering questions, she seemed to have some excellent news for fans of Pride and Prejudice, Emma, and all Jane Austen's other works. Could the author possibly be in a position to write some more? Andrea Leadsom was responding to another MP's list of successful women.
I'm delighted to join in celebrating, and that's that of Jane Austen, who will feature on the new £10 note, which I think is another one of our greatest living authors. Greatest ever authors. And I think it's fantastic that at last we're starting to recognise. Well, I think many of us probably wish she were still living.
Andrea Leadsom in the week of the 200th anniversary of Jane Austen's death. Before we go, our main news again. The Community Secretary has said Grenfell Tower residents feel not a lot of trust, not a lot of confidence in Kensington and Chelsea Council. And that's it for a while. Parliament is on its summer break until the 5th of September. We'll be back then too. I'm Susan Hume. The editor was Keith McDougall. And that was the Today in Parliament podcast. Thanks for listening.
You can download many more BBC Radio 4 programmes for free. Find these at bbc.co.uk/radio4.